Today at Reader's Corner, my guest is Chris Bokjalian, author of the thrilling novel, The Flight Attendant. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to this encore edition of Reader's Corner. Our guest is best-selling author Chris Bokjalian, author of The Flight Attendant.
The Flight Attendant focuses on Cassandra Bowden, an airline worker who wakes in a Dubai hotel with a hangover, a head full of foggy memories, and a dead man lying next to her. A powerful story about the ways an entire life can change in one night. The Flight Attendant is one of those books you pick up and don't put down until the last page, and I can vouch for that. Chris Bokjalian is the author of 20 books, including The Guest Room, Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands, The Sandcastle Girls, Skeletons at the Feast, The Double Bind, and Midwives, which was a number one bestseller at the New York Times and a selection of Oprah's Book Club. Chris's work has been translated into more than 30 languages, and three of his novels have been made into movies. Chris Bokjalian, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Bob, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, as I was discussing before we went on the air, we don't want to give anything away when it comes to a thriller that takes the reader on a journey of international intrigue as The Flight Attendant does. So maybe I'll just hand it off to you at the outset here and set up the potential reader for what they're going to be reading in The Flight Attendant.
Sure. The Flight Attendant had its origins back in March of 2016. I had just flown from Yerevan, Armenia to JFK in New York City, and I was meeting a friend for dinner at 7:30. I got to the restaurant about 6:30 and dropped off my bags in the code room, and because I was an hour early, I went to the bar. And I will never glamorize alcoholism because I come from a family of alcoholics on both sides, but darn, that bar was beautiful. And we've all been in a beautiful bar, the highball glasses, the martini glasses, the wine glasses, the bottles impeccably lit. And three threads came together alchemically to create the book that you were gracious enough to read. The first thread was the bar, the beauty of the booze. The second was the miracle of aviation. I had breakfast in the Caucasus, and I'm having dinner in New York City, and you can only do that because of the miracle of aviation. So even when I'm in the very back row of a 737 with my back flush against the lavatory, I try never to lose sight of the fact I'm flying. And third, Russia. I'd flown on Aeroflot. I actually fly Aeroflot at least once or twice a year, and I've always been fascinated by Russia. This is a country that gave us the Bolshoi Ballet, Tchaikovsky, and Dostoevsky, and yet, without fail, whoever is running the show in the Kremlin is an actual James Bond villain. And so I asked the bartender for all the scrap paper he had, and I started to write. And I wrote the first 3.5 pages of the novel on scrap paper at that bar with a pen, and my premise was simply this. Alcoholic, hot mess of a flight attendant, blackout drunk, picks up the passenger in flight 2C on the way into Dubai, wakes up the next morning and finds out that the guy is dead. That's all I knew going into the book.
That's perfect. Well, let's start with the Russia part. And I'm curious to know exactly when this moment was that you sat down and discovered this novel, because in a sense, since your novel, perhaps before your novel, intelligence work, spycraft by another name, has become quite newsworthy in the last couple of years, thanks to Putin, Trump, Russian interference in elections, a U.S. government charging a Russian woman with conspiracy to act as a Russian agent, and then just fairly recently, the arrest of a former U.S. Marine in Russia by Russia claiming that he's a spy. How does all of this, and I know this last incident certainly can't fit into your novel because it's a year after you've written the novel, but go back to the beginning of when you did this. Were you influenced not just by your travel to Russia, but what you were reading in the newspapers as well?
Oh, absolutely. The book took one of those wonderful left-hand turns when I was about 6 months into it in September of 2016. I was back in Armenia, and I was at the line of contact between Armenia and Azerbaijan doing a story for the New York Times, and I was standing there, you know, flak jackets on, chatting with a British-Armenian philanthropist who does a lot of business in Ukraine and in Dubai. And we were just chatting, and he started telling me stories about what happens when you're dealing with a certain breed of Russian oligarch and the deal goes bad. It doesn't get messy. It gets literally bloody. And we started hearing stories about Russian meddling in the 2016 election.
Whoa.
This is all eye candy if you're a novelist, especially if you're writing a book where you know Russia and espionage is going to figure into it, but you're still trying to figure out precisely how. But I got to tell you, when the book was published in hardcover in March, a day didn't go by when I wouldn't be reading news stories about Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner following the money to Ukraine or Dubai, and thinking to myself, thank you, Paul Manafort. Thank you, Jared Kushner.
That's right. That's right.
Well, also, I noticed somewhere toward the end of your book, one of your characters reflects on, I guess, what I would call the Russian character from her point of view. Do you pick that up by traveling to Russia? And
the thing that I was getting at in that passage is that one of the things that is really clear historically is the only people who can defeat Russia are Russians. That's just a historical reality. The Russian soul is so many millennia, has spent so much millennia becoming cynical and skeptical and in some ways really hard-hearted. Now, there is also a strain of the Russian soul that is absolutely so beautiful and so sweet, and you see all of that in great Russian literature. You see it in Dr. Zhivago. You see it in Anna Karenina. You certainly see it in Dostoevsky and Nabokov. And one of the books that recent books that really gets that so beautifully is Amor Tolle's A Gentleman in Moscow, the yin and yang of the Russian soul. And I'm an Armenian-American. Armenia was a Soviet republic for 70 years. So there's certainly a part of me when I'm in Armenia that spends time with a lot of Russians and a lot of Armenians who grew up as kids in the Soviet Union.
By the way, Amor Tolles was on Reader's Corner, and we interviewed him. And it's very interesting. I noticed that he, of course, was confined to the Metropole Hotel. And that's where they arrested the former U.S. Marine, who they claim is the spy. I just thought that was a little bit of a coincidence for me anyway.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Isn't that absolutely, absolutely incredible? I mean, you know, my goal in life is never to write the same book twice. A lot of my books are historical fiction, and a lot of my books are contemporary literature. And I know what's so fun for me with The Flight Attendant is, yes, it's a thriller, and yes, it's contemporary literature, but I hope it is placing a thriller in a certain historical context.
Well, you drop some pretty famous literature in this novel. Shakespeare gets his way in here. Greek mythology finds its way. Tolstoy has a mention or two.
And so does one of my favorite Russians, Pushkin, Eugene Onegin, absolutely.
Yeah. So is that something you do regularly as you write your novels, trying to remind our listeners that there's some great works that came before yours?
Well, I certainly understand that literature is a great river. And whenever you wade into it, you're not necessarily wading into it exactly the same spot because there are always great new books coming out. And I think all of us, whether we're Amor Tolles or whether we're Barbara Kingsolver or whether we're John Grisham or me, we are part of a really, really long tradition, not just of novels, but of storytelling. And right now, given how politically divisive our country is, one of the great things literature can do is remind us is that we might be really red or really blue, we might really disagree about politics, but we can often find commonality in literature.
Well, there's no doubt about that. You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Chris Bokjalian, author of the new novel, The Flight Attendant. The plot of The Flight Attendant, it is about international intrigue, and I wonder, did that represent for you any particular challenge when it comes to the kind of research you have to do? I know in your acknowledgments you mentioned a few books you were reading at the time you were writing the novel, or did you just fit right into this genre because it's all around us these days?
I think part of it is you're absolutely right. It is all around us these days. espionage and spycraft is no longer simply the stuff we read in Cold War novels or in contemporary thrillers. It's stuff that's in the newspapers. It's stuff that's on television, on the news, cable stations. Because we are seeing just all of the 21st century ways that we use spycraft and espionage. Now, the other thing that I think I was doing with this book, though, is harking back to a great Cold War tradition of the flight attendant as spy. When I was growing up, one of my uncle's five wives was what we called in the Mesozoic era of my childhood a stewardess or a flight attendant. Right. But she was brilliant and beautiful and young, and she flew internationally, which meant that she disappeared for 3 or 4 days at a time, because in the 1960s and the 1970s, you weren't texting from Moscow, you weren't posting Instagram photos from Paris, you were just off radar. So it really was a great cover for a spy, and I will never forget my mom telling my brother and me one night at dinner, she said, "You know, kids, don't you? Your Aunt Liz is a spy." Now, who knows if Aunt Liz really was a spy or not, but certainly that was in the back of my mind. Now, I knew that my main character, Cassandra Bowden, herself wasn't going to be a spy because she's a mess. I love her, but, you know, she's like Camille Preaker in Sharp Objects. She makes unbelievably bad decisions, and she's the kind of wounded bird who flies into your living room window one morning, dusts off her wings, and flies into the window again the next day. So she wasn't a spy. I was actually thinking more of, again, to go back to sort of those Cold War days, Roger Thornhill in that great Alfred Hitchcock movie, North by Northwest.
Yes.
Roger Thornhill, played by Cary Grant,
yep,
is a functional alcoholic who spends the first half of the movie wondering who's trying to kill him, and then the second half of the movie with Eva Marie Saint, knowing it's the Russians, trying to stay one step ahead. That was what I was after in The Flight Attendant with Cassie Bowden, a mess of a flight attendant who is sometimes doesn't even realize how much danger she is in. She thinks she's just afraid of being busted for maybe killing a guy in a blackout bender. She has no idea just how precarious her position is, but the reader does.
So now that we're on to Cassandra, I've got another question here that relates to her flight attendant status. And you've alluded to it with your mention of the old stewardess days. First of all, Cassie obviously likes overnight stands and gets very drunk, wakes up in the morning, doesn't remember. But if you go back to another generation, my wife was a stewardess,
and
the person you described, although she didn't do as much international, but in case our younger listeners may not remember, you couldn't be married, women only, and you were weighed in on a regular basis. And if you were over the weight that they thought you should be, you were off the plane. And probably a lot of other things, too, dealing with makeup and how they looked and having to pass judgment. So I have to ask you the question. Did the flight attendants union find you and say, "Hey, wait a minute, Chris, we're not all like that. She's the exception to the rule."
The vast majority of flight attendants have read this book, and I've done a bunch of book groups with flight attendants. Really love the book because, you know, they understand that Cassie Bowden isn't emblematic of a profession any more than any fictional character in a book is meant to be emblematic of an entire profession. She is a flight attendant who happens to be an alcoholic. Not all alcoholics are flight attendants. Now, that point noted, I've certainly heard from some flight attendants who were really angry at me because they were worried that I was either suggesting that flight attendants are not responsible women and men, or B, that all flight attendants are that sexually promiscuous. But I think for every flight attendant who's chastised me, I've heard from 3 or 4 who said, "Oh my gosh, you nailed it. I know somebody just like Cassie Bowden." Yeah.
So how did you manage to nail it when it comes to understanding and writing about the life of a flight attendant?
You know, I interviewed a lot of flight attendants.
Mm-hmm.
I fly a lot, and so I've always understood that passengers behave abysmally these days on airplanes.
No kidding.
The days when, you know, we would wear blazers and ties and dresses to get on an airplane are just gone. I mean, I am really old school. I still always wear a blazer and tie shoes on a plane. But most of the world doesn't. I mean, I'm surrounded by people on airplanes in flip-flops and shorts. And so I interviewed a lot of flight attendants, both to understand the realities of their job and to understand passenger misbehavior. And the stories that they would tell me about the passengers who would try to climb over the beverage cart to get to the lavatory, sometimes with bare feet. The stories they would tell me of the A-list celebrities who would insist you never make eye contact with me. I came across three flight attendants who told me stories of coming across naked passengers on the airplane. And we're despicable. I have no idea what happens to us when we get on an airplane, but I think flight attendants are amazing. The work they do to keep us comfortable and safe
right.
at 35,000 feet, it just amazes me.
So one of the things that I read in one of the early reviews of your book was the fact that your book deals with a woman who gets very drunk and then engages in sex with partners. And by the way, I don't want the listeners to think that's the whole book. This is not 50 Shades of Grey or anything. Please, this is a book of international intrigue, and it just happens to have this person. But anyway, on with the story. There's the Me Too movement. And I guess the question is, hey, wow, you know, she's doing all this, but might she have been raped in these sexual encounters? I don't really know whether that has anything to do with your book or your reaction to the Me Too movement or whatever, but I just thought I'd bring it up so you can comment.
I think it's a great thing to bring up. And in fact, one of my favorite characters in the book is Cassie Bowden's lawyer, Ani Mouradian. And Ani so Cassie's going over her history over the last week with her lawyer. And she mentions that, you know, yeah, she's had sex when she's been drunk, and she's probably had sex that she doesn't remember because it's blackout. But, you know, Cassie says, but, you know, it's not like I was raped. And her attorney says, that's not consensual. When you are passed out drunk and somebody's having sex with you, that's not okay, Cassie. And Ani's quite clear about that. And Ani is, I hope, a voice of sort of that Me Too movement to point out that when guys do this to women, it's not okay. Just as no means no, being passed out means no.
I'm glad you pointed that out. That's a very important part of the book, without question. Let's talk for a moment about the craft of writing a novel. What's your habit? Do you put the outline together? I think I know the answer to this, but do you put the outline together and then just fill in, or do you let these characters take off and see where they go?
I wish I were a good enough writer to do outlines. I have absolutely no idea where my books are going. When I start, I've just got a really vague premise. And then I depend on my characters to take me by the hand and lead me through the dark of the story. I do a lot of research as I write. I often have to stop for a day or two to interview a flight attendant or interview an attorney or interview an FBI agent, in the case of this kind of book, or an expert on drones, because you know, this book even has a lot of references to drone warfare and to the cataclysm that has been Syria since 2011. I'm usually at my desk at about 6 in the morning, sometimes earlier. I'm just finished researching or doing a lot of research for a book set in Vietnam, so I've been cultivating my Vietnam jet lag, and I've been at my desk at about 4:30 in the morning, which has been just a great gift, and I write until lunchtime.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Chris Bogjalian, author of The Flight Attendant. The novel is a powerful story about the ways an entire life can change in one night. So when will the Vietnam book come out?
It's tentatively scheduled for March of 2020, but that could change either to April or January, because my first full-length play opens at the George Street Playhouse that spring, so we're trying to coordinate all of that. I was so enamored with flight attendants and their work that my first play opened this past summer in New York City, and it's called Wingspan, and it's about two flight attendants. It has nothing to do with my novel. It's actually a play, going back to your earlier question, about the Me Too movement. and one young woman who harbors just a horrific secret, which slowly comes out in the course of the play. And that will also be a Penguin Random House audio, so you can actually hear that stage play in February.
So what about movie rights to either this one? I mean, you certainly have had other novels that have found their way onto the screen. What about this?
Oh, I couldn't be happier than to tell you that the world's most perfect person to play an alcoholic hot mess of a flight attendant is going to play her in a 10-hour limited series. It's been optioned by her and by Warner Brothers Television, and that actor is none other than the Big Bang Theory's Penny, or Kaylee Cuoco.
Oh, wow. Congratulations on that.
I just couldn't be happier. I think Kaylee is so perfect to bring Cassie Bowden to life.
Yeah. Now, what role do you think you'll play in that, or do you never know until they decide to film?
Oh, no, I know exactly what role I'm playing.
Okay.
Nothing. I'm somewhat less important than the guys who do craft services and provide the coffee. I mean, and that's by choice. I pick and choose what projects I'm going to be more involved with. So, for example, I am involved with the adaptation of my novel Skeletons at the Feast, a novel about one German family's complicity in the Holocaust in World War II. I'm involved in the development of The Guest Room, a novel about the world's worst bachelor party and human trafficking, and one of the co-writers also of the independent film adaptation of my novel, The Sleepwalker.
Now, some authors at least get a cameo role in these movies. How about you, Chris?
Nope. The three times my books have become movies, I was on the set for a couple days, had a great time, but you will not see me doing the Alfred Hitchcock thing and appearing anywhere in the film, and that's fine. I know that my ugly mug is not going to make any film better.
You know, there was one aspect of your novel that brought a little bit of my past back to me. I lived in eastern Kentucky, just a few miles from the Bluegrass Army Depot. And I was president at Eastern Kentucky University, and at the time, we literally had drills and schedules on what would happen and how the university would react if there was some kind of a incident at the depot itself. How did that? First of all, you might explain to our listeners, I don't think it's going to ruin the novel, how that gets in, or to the extent that you can, and then how did you find that? That's really and I think there's two of them. There's one west of us here in Boise, and they're storing all that nasty stuff we used or thought we were going to use years ago.
Yeah. One of the espionage elements to the flight attendant is the use of drones and the role of chemical weapons because of the Russian presence in Syria. And two threads in my research came together that utterly fascinated me. A friend of mine at the Pentagon was helping me with my drone research, and I didn't realize this, but we are the only nation in the world that has weaponized a drone. Lots of nations have drones, but we are the only nation that can attach a Hellfire missile to a drone, control it, and fire it. China is just about there, but Russia doesn't have a weaponized drone, for example. Secondly, we all know that Assad, in all likelihood with the complicity of his Russian handlers, used chemical weapons on his own people in the midst of the Syrian civil war. So when I was chatting with some military folks about drones and chemical weapons, it dawned on me that this is one of the next ugly frontiers of dark weaponry, the kinds of weaponry that rogue nations use, and that is weaponizing a drone with chemical weapons.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. It does wake up the reader when you get to that part of the novel. There's no question about that. I want to ask you a question about the reviews. Novelists have to put up with how other people who are actually paid to write these reviews think about your work. Do you ever read the? First of all, do you read them? Secondly, if you do read them, do you ever come back and think, boy, I wish I had done that? Or when they come up with an idea that, he didn't do enough of this or he did too much of that. How does a novelist react in a situation like that?
First of all, I read every review I'm aware of. Uh-huh. And I'm aware of almost every single review because in the digital networks, it's almost impossible not to read them. I read the good ones, I read the bad ones. The bad ones make me sad. sometimes there are things in the bad reviews that help me to grow, help me to see, well, you know, I think that that reviewer was onto something. I wish I had done that better. Sometimes they just disappoint me because I feel like the reviewer didn't get it. But I also understand that one of the great privileges of my life is what I get to do. And if you're going to be a novelist, you've got to accept the fact that your books are going to be reviewed, and sometimes they're going to be great reviews and you're going to be thrilled, and sometimes they're not going to be so great. And that's just somebody's job. And the wonderful thing about literature is that it's not algebra. Two people can have wildly diverse opinions and both be correct. Now, the thing I do steer clear of is it's really important for my mental health to completely steer clear of what people are saying on Amazon or Goodreads. Those are not necessarily critics who have, you know, a master's in literature and are really educated in terms of how to review a book. So those can just be devastating. And so I go nowhere near Goodreads and Amazon reviews. In fact, when my books first come out, it's up to my editor to just sort of tell me, you're doing fine on Amazon, you're at 4 stars, it's okay, don't sweat it, because otherwise I won't know.
Yeah, you will. I was obviously thinking of the kinds of reviews that will find their way into the Washington Post book club or the New York Times book section, but I'm glad you did mention that. I have to admit, as a reader, that I do go onto Amazon and look at the percentages, but when I start reading the comments, I quickly realize that too many of these folks just really aren't worth listening to. I mean, they really don't know what they're reading, and they may have completely different tastes than I have. And that's the biggest thing, is that they're just different than I am. So what am I reading these people for? Anyway, I get your point.
That's one of the most important mental health tips that I've given right. to so many first novelists who are so excited when their first book is coming out, and that is this. Enjoy every moment of it, except the great blessing of being a writer, and don't go anywhere near Goodreads and Amazon to read what people are saying about your work.
Yeah. Well, the good news for us here at Reader's Corner at this moment, talking about The Flight Attendant, is that it had very good reviews. And Chris, I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the book is The Flight Attendant by Chris Bookjalian. Thanks so much for being with us.
Bob, it's a real pleasure. I'm sorry that that Idaho isn't on the tour when I go on tour for the paperback, but gosh, as I've always loved my appearances in Idaho, and I hope I get back soon.
Great. We'd love to have you. Thank you so much.
Take care.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Chris Bookjalian. Next week, Patrick Radin Keefe, author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. On the subject of what we've been reading lately, every now and then I read a book that presents challenges when it comes to interviewing the author at Reader's Corner. A River in Darkness, One Man's Escape from North Korea by Masaji Ishikawa. A harrowing account of a man's escape from North Korea, but only after a lifetime of hunger, starvation, brutality, and despair. A River in Darkness is Masaji Ishikawa's story of life in North Korea and his eventual flight to freedom and back to Japan. It is a remarkable tale of brutal living conditions, poverty and hunger experienced in a crushing totalitarian regime. But it is also an inspiring example of the indomitable human spirit and how, in Ishikawa's flight back to Japan, he overcomes the tragic circumstances of his North Korean life, only to be confronted by a new set of realities back in Japan. So what's the challenge with interviewing Mr. Ishikawa? Well, as you might guess, he does not speak English. In fact, he wrote this book in the year 2000, and it was just translated into English in 2017. Books that deal with human suffering and deprivation can make for a tough read and something you might want to avoid. But there was something about this man's story that just called me to read it. Perhaps it's a matter of paying tribute to anyone who could endure what he did and find a way to escape what would have been destiny for most mortals. I hope you find it as inspiring as I did. If you have a book whose author you think we should interview, please let us know by going to BoiseStatePublicRadio.org and the Reader's Corner website and leave a message with our producer. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.